Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the weekend, thousands of mostly peaceful citizens took to the streets of San Francisco and Berkeley to stand against far-right and white supremacist rallies. This follows the deadly rally in Charlottesville. Donald Trump's presidency has mobilized people across the country, many who've never been involved in the political process before, but are now energized and involved. We are seeing massive crowds of mostly white people screaming things like Black Lives Matter. So how should we capitalize on this moment? How should we talk about issues like race and class in the Trump era? On today's Your Call, we are joined by two historians. Tyler Stovall is the Dean of the Humanities Division at UC Santa Cruz and President of the American Historical Association. That's an organization that advocates for history education and the critical role of historical thinking in public life. Tyler Stovall is the author of several books, including Black France, The History and Politics of Blackness. He's currently working on a book about freedom and race called White Freedom. And Tyler Stovall joins us from Berkeley. Hi, Tyler. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Nancy Eisenberg, professor of history at Louisiana State University. Nancy is author of several books, including her latest, White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. We had Nancy on the show when that book came out. Nancy spent her summer in Charlottesville. She wasn't there during the deadly rally, but she has been thinking a lot about how to deal with all of these issues. And Nancy joins us from Louisiana. Hi, Nancy. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, I'm so happy to have both of you because this is such a needed conversation. It is an amazing time when you look at what's happening. So many rallies across the country. People are taking to the streets in droves to stand up to race and hatred. Over the weekend, people in New York had a debate about whether to take down the Christopher Columbus statue. We're just seeing incredible things happening. And I wonder, as historians who've spent a lot of time writing, thinking, teaching about race and class in the United States, what does this moment mean to you? Nancy Eisenberg, let's start off with you.
Well, I think that one of the issues that we have to deal with is that, unfortunately, Americans do not know history very well. And this is one of the challenges. I mean, I've been writing for Salon.com about when politicians make claims about history and they're wrong. And this is one of the challenges, that most of the history that Americans know is either what they got in grade school and it's not even guaranteed you get much history in high school anymore. And on top of that, what they get from TV, what they get from Hollywood, what they get from local and shallow public celebrations. So we have a real problem when we don't understand our past. And this is why I am a historian, because when we fail to educate the public accurately about history, and this is also, since I wrote a biography of Aaron Burr, I also wrote critiques of Hamilton, which everyone loves, but it's not historically accurate. Mm. And this is one of the problems, is that people want to choose the historical narrative that they like, rather than know the whole story.
Nancy, why is it that we don't know our history? I mean, we were talking recently about what we learn about immigration, for example, what we learn about Native American genocide. Sadly, we don't learn much. Why is that?
Well, I mean, part of it is that myth trumps fact. And we've been very good about making myths about America. This is why America defines itself as an exceptional society. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did a radio interview with Australia over white trash, and they were sort of so surprised to realize that Australians' early history is a lot like our early history in terms of convict labor, indentured servants. But we, in the United States, turned it into a story about, you know, that we were, you know, people only came here for religious liberty, as Michelle Bachmann claimed, or that somehow we were destined to be a great nation. And that's why people also get very angry if you challenge that mythology. Hmm. And right now, for a long time, we've been in this backlash period where anyone who says anything that's critical, who talks about class oppression or slavery, or talks about the fact that women didn't get the vote in this country until 1919, and we had child labor in this country until 1916, seem to not want to know the truth. They prefer the happy story. They prefer to imagine, and this is why it's very popular in Trump's era, because he's going to make America great again, and that's a line he stole from Ronald Reagan, that people want the story, and they link that to patriotism, and that's where it gets dangerous.
Hmm. Tyler Stovall, what about you? What are you thinking right now in this moment?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I want to second everything that Nancy said. I think there is a real tendency in America to see history is something that is of no consequence. I mean, all you need to do is consider the phrase, it's history, which means that it doesn't matter. And tied to that is very much a strong narrative of progress, which is that it's not the past that counts, but the future. So there is that, and I think that when you do start to look at history, I mean, you know, for example, we had over a week ago, a woman who died because of a historical dispute. Mm-hmm. History clearly does matter. But I wanted to also mention another point, which I think plays into this, and this is a broader issue, which is that since the 1970s, 1980s, you've basically seen two overarching historical processes developing in not just the United States, but the world as a whole. On the one hand, the world is becoming more diverse, much more multicultural, much more interactive in terms of cultures from throughout the world. And you see this, of course, not just in the United States, but in Europe and throughout the world. But the other thing that's going on, pretty much at the same time, is you have a decline in working class living standards.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is that it is much harder for people that are not wealthy, certainly in the Western world, certainly in America and Europe, to make it than it used to be. You know, to give a personal example, my parents were able to send me and my sister, who's 10 months younger than me, to private universities without taking out loans or taking out financial aid of any kind. And they're not at all wealthy. They were not at all wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
So that was possible for middle-class people at a time in the 60s, 70s. It is no longer possible today. So I think part of what we see now is the intersection of these two phenomena. Why is it that while the world is becoming more multicultural, on the one hand, working class living standards are declining on the other, and how do people react to those two facts? Because I think the combination of those two is really driving a lot of the political reactions we're seeing today.
Yes, and it's so important to talk about both. And Tyler, I wonder, what are your thoughts about what Nancy said about what we don't learn in history class? You are the president of the American Historical Association. I mean, you advocate for history teachers and history professors. Why is it that we don't learn so much of this important history, and what will it take to change that?
Okay, I should also say I have a son who's a junior in high school and is taking a history class right now, so that's been a very interesting experience for me to follow what he's learning and what he's not learning also. I think there's a lot of reasons for it. I think that, you know, history is, you know, is one of the liberal arts, and there's an increasing idea in America that the liberal arts do not matter because they do not lead inexorably to getting a kind of well-paying job that people feel they need to survive in today's economy. We've seen in many universities a decline of history enrollments as part of the decline of humanities enrollments in general, because people are told, both students and parents, that unless you take engineering, unless you take STEM courses, you will not be able to get a job in today's world or tomorrow's world. So there's that. I think also people find, as Nancy said, history sort of, and historians perhaps even, sort of annoying, because we do sort of tend to trash people's cherished myths and look at the ways in which they are, you know, creating a myth out of the past that is not at all true in many cases. So I think part of the goal of the American Historical Association is to try and make history as ubiquitous as possible. And it's funny because we're in a sort of strange situation. On the one hand, in some ways, history is very popular. Nancy mentioned the success of Hamilton.
Mm.
Now, it's not the kind of history I would necessarily agree with, but it is people's vision of history, and as such, it is incredibly popular. You can look at many other examples of popular culture, even things like Civil War reenactments, for example, or Renaissance fairs that represent a kind of popular history that is very popular. I think the challenge for us is to make sure that that is accurate as possible and does not take certain things in without questioning them. So I think those are some of the challenges. A final challenge, I think, and I say this as a parent of a teenager, is that, increasingly a lot of people don't read today.
Mm.
You know, increasingly they get their knowledge from little bits of information on the internet that's pre-digested and often not at all related to any historical accuracy. And I think that's a real challenge, too.
Mm. Tyler Stovall is Dean of the Humanities Division at UC Santa Cruz and President of the American Historical Association. He's the author of several books. He's working on one right now about freedom and race called White Freedom. Nancy Eisenberg is Professor of History at Louisiana State University. Her last book is White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America, now out in paperback. Nancy, you spent your summer in Charlottesville. You were not there during the deadly attack. But you've been thinking about it like so many of us and thinking about how to deal with this. What are your thoughts? I mean, we move so quickly in this country, and we're going to do a show next week to check in with people in Charlottesville to find out how they're coping. Some people have said they're dealing with PTSD. But what are you thinking about right now?
Yeah, I have a friend who's actually been working with that, with running sessions in Charlottesville for people dealing with the reaction to the events. So yes, it's very personal for people. I mean, you feel as if your hometown has been invaded. Mm. And you know, there's several things I'd like to comment on in response to what has been said. I mean, when I keep thinking, one of the things we have to realize is, you know, the history of these monuments themselves. And part of the problem, I just read an article today in the Post that says that there's at least 223 Civil War monuments in Virginia alone, and that's more than there are in Texas. And part of the problem, when I think about this issue, one of the things that, there are two things that come to mind. One is I don't like the idea of just tearing down monuments without explaining the past or explaining where these monuments came from. But when I talked to a friend last week, I was thinking, what I would like to replace the monuments, and these are men, white men on horses, who were traitors, I would like to replace it with a book. And this is a comment in response to what was said about the lack of reading, where people, instead of staring at a man on a horse, they would have to stop and read. And they would have to actually think about history.
Mm.
And this makes me think about the importance of the Vietnam Memorial in Washington. It's one of the most popular ones. And they had a big debate, as you probably remember, about whether to put statues of humans, which was added later, because that's not what people go there for. They go there to look at the names. They go there to remember people who died. And I think this is part of the problem. These monuments do come from a very different era. They do have a very politicized legacy. They were not only built by Jim Crow, but they were built by organizations like, you know, the Daughters of the Confederacy. And they were used to make a very clear political statement. And we do not have an equal amount of monuments. And we certainly don't, as a feminist, we certainly don't have very many monuments to women or the women's rights movement in this country. And this is part of the problem, is that these are not neutral monuments, but I don't like the idea of just erasing history. I would like to replace it with something where people have to talk about it, they have to learn about it, and not just sort of assume the problem is gone once you get rid of the statue.
Right. Tyler, what do you think?
I think that's an excellent idea. And, I mean, there's different kinds of ways of remembering the past in public space. I mean, for example, in Paris and other French cities, if you walk down the street and look at buildings, oftentimes you will see plaques that memorialize, for example, Jews that were deported to the death camps of World War II. And they're not big and flashy. They are just little things that you, yes, have to stand and read for a moment to learn about this or that family, why they were deported, what happened to them, so on and so forth. So there's a tendency that when we do those kinds of memorializations in public space, they're very sort of low-key and much more thoughtful, as opposed to the grand figure of the man on horseback, which traditionally was also a symbol of dictatorship, the man on horseback. So I don't agree either with the idea of simply tearing them down. But I do think one of the things that Charlottesville in this whole context has revealed is that there's an awful lot of lack of understanding of why these monuments came to be in the first place, why they're there, what role they play, so on and so forth. And it's interesting to put this in international perspective, because in most cases, when you have these kind of monuments, they're built by a regime, And when that regime is overthrown, as was the case in, say, Romania in 1989, the monuments that were built by that regime are then overthrown as well. The Confederate monuments are completely different. They were built, for the most part, well after the Confederacy was defeated, as a way of celebrating its sort of the resurgence of white supremacy in a whole different context. So there's overlapping layers of history attached to them. And I think one of the things that would be important is that in discussing the fate of these monuments, people certainly, first of all, come to understand why they came to be in the first place.
Well, if you'd like to join us today, we are talking about how to really capitalize on this moment at a time when we're having a debate about monuments. I was wondering if Christopher Columbus was going to be part of the debate, and surely he is, because over the weekend, people in New York, if you've ever been to Central Park, there's this massive statue of Christopher Columbus. And in New York, they're debating, along with government officials, whether to take that down. So that's happening. We're seeing rallies across the country. So many people are standing up to hate and racism, and we're having a very important discussion right now. What do you think about where we are today? How should we capitalize on this moment? How can we bring other issues into this conversation, like class, for example? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. If you have been to any of the rallies, what are you talking about with your friends and family about this time? And what are your thoughts about where we are right now? We have an email actually from Chris who says, this conversation is frustrating because Americans don't care about history or historical accuracy. They would rather just believe their myths. So how can we really deal with that, Nancy? We talked a little bit about it earlier, but what else?
Yeah, before I answer that, I just wanted to add to what Tyler was saying about the international context on the class issues, because I've written a piece for the Hedgehog Review, which is talking about how this class debate is also a debate between cosmopolitanism versus provincialism. Mm-hmm. And this is the other problem we face, about how national identities get shaped and the way in which this is a really an old battle that has been revived. This was clearly part of Brexit. And it also gets tied into class identity, because what has happened in this country, and one of the issues we really have to confront, is that there really is a big divide between urban America and rural America. It's not surprising that the majority of rural Americans ended up voting for Trump, in part because this reinforces the other divide, which Tyler talked about, the educational divide, that most of our amenities tend to be located in cities. This is when people are young. They often leave rural areas to go to the city. There's also a sense of entitlement that comes with being part of the hip cosmopolitan urban environment. It also reflects the change in our economy, the growth of tech jobs, the growth of the internet, mm-hmm. the idea that we have another problem in this country, which I've also addressed, which is the problem that Tyler alluded to, is who actually goes to college today? Mm. Who goes to the top schools in our country? In fact, it's not just dominated by race, it's actually dominated by class. It's wealthy white people who are benefiting the most and who have the privileges and the ability to get into elite colleges today and even elite state colleges. So we know we have this increasing gap, this class gap, which has been augmented by the decline of unions, by the failure to deal with the transformation, the growth of the global economy. But there's also a cultural identity that people attach to place and where they come from. And there's a long-standing resentment that people in rural America who don't like being dismissed as boobs, who don't like being dismissed as rubes, who don't like being dismissed as people who are whose values don't matter, that they're not the trendsetters, that's identified with cosmopolitanism. Now, these are big problems, and they're not going to be solved because they have a longer history, and that's the trajectory that we're headed. But we do have to address the way in which we subscribe to certain class biases, and they're tied up in this divide between the cosmopolitan lifestyle versus the provincial lifestyle.
Tyler, what would you add to that?
I think all that is spot on. I mean, for example, living in the Bay Area, I teach at an elite public university. But, you know, one of the things we have to deal with is the fact that many of our students come from first-generation backgrounds. Many of them are really struggling to survive. I mean, we have a whole sort of dirty secret about students that are literally living in their cars because they cannot afford housing, stuff like that. So, and yet they are also part of this, you know, cosmopolitan world, certainly not a cosmopolitan elite. So I'm from Ohio originally, and a lot of the people I went to school with really fit into that paradigm of very religious, very sort of conservative. And yet they see themselves as really discriminated against in this culture, both culturally and economically as well. So I think that one of the challenges we face is untangling those strands, because it's important to point out that the working class is not just the white working class. In fact, if you look at it economically,
right,
people of color are more likely to be working class than white people are in America. But, you know, one of the things that came out recently was that whole series of surveys about the increasing rise of suicide rates among white working class men in particular. And what this points to is that it's not just about income. It is also about how you feel about your place in society. And I think what Nancy is talking about is the fact that many people feel that they are not just oppressed economically, and especially compared to their parents and especially compared to what they were led to expect would be their lives, but also that's not acknowledged, but it's also not acknowledged that they are discriminated, rejected culturally. That, you know, for example, it's very hard to have a conversation about religion in an American university and have it taken seriously, for example.
Right, and you can also, you can add the opioid crisis to your list.
Right, and the opioid crisis is interesting because, of course, as people have pointed out, when opiates were a problem for Black and Latino populations, it was a crisis of public order.
Right.
Now it's a crisis of public health. So there's that dimension, but nonetheless, it is a real crisis. Mm. You go into small-town America and see just the lives that are ruined by opiates, it is a major problem, and it is a problem that reflects a certain lack of hope and a certain belief that nobody is listening to their problems and nobody has any solutions for them.
Well, before we go to break, I mean, you're both bringing up so many important issues here. What do you think about what you're hearing from various movements on the ground, whether it's Black Lives Matter, the unions, the Fight for 15, the environmental movement? What do you think about the different messages? What do you think is most effective at this point, Nancy?
Well, this is one of the things I wrote in the Hedgehog Review piece, is that I think, I mean, I would like to see the government and I even suggest the Democrats to rethink the New Deal. For example, when we talk about global warming, there are also environmental issues that can reunify people and the separation between urban America and rural America. For example, water pollution, mm-hmm. which of course Trump is sort of undermining. But this is something that affects places like Louisiana. It affects, you know, places where whether it's, you know, not just in parks and natural environments, but urban areas. And I think one of the messages that we need to think about is how can we bridge the gap, the division between urban and urban America, and realize that we have economic, political interests that are united. And I also want to add that Trump's policies that he put forward are going to hurt rural America. I mean, this is the sad thing about American politics, mm-hmm. is that people often vote for irrational reasons, and that Trump has, you know, put forward not only removing Obamacare, but all of his plans for health care reform would make rural Americans not only insurance deserts, but they're already becoming deserts that are lacking hospitals and facilities to deal with just basic health care issues. And this is one of the issues that is very hard to get across in our current political environment without it being seen as, and I think this unfortunately has been exploited by Republicans, where they want to present health care in the old welfare narrative, that somehow this is people getting some kind of handout they don't deserve, despite the fact that the middle class since World War II has gotten lots of handouts, but somehow they deserved it, they earned it. And this is one of the problems that we tend to face, is that we want to believe the old myth that everyone can do it on their own, which they can't. And then we also want to believe that somehow government has become too geared toward helping the undeserving. And we have a tough time dealing with that. We have a tough time realizing that actually a large number of people will drop behind below the poverty line. So the idea that everybody is stable in their class position isn't true, and the idea that everyone's going to move up into the upper class is also false. So we should actually be more considerate about people who are dealing with tough times, because you might be in that exact same position 5 years from now.
Nancy Eisenberg is professor of history at Louisiana State University and author of White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. Tyler Stovall is the dean of the Humanities Division at UC Santa Cruz and president of the American Historical Association. He's the author of several books, including Black France, the History and Politics of Blackness. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about the best ways to capitalize on this moment. How should we talk about all of these issues, race, class, labor, so many others in the Trump era? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience you want to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website, set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, and you can also tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about foster children. 500,000 children live in foster care in the United States. More than 100,000 are waiting to be adopted. And recent studies show that growing numbers of people who want to adopt say they'd consider adopting a foster child. We'll talk about that tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, we'll talk about Native American activism. On Wednesday night, there's an event called Exploring Red Power in the 1960s at the California Historical Society. You can find more information about it at californiahistoricalsociety.org. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can subscribe to Your Call on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. And if you do listen to us on a podcast, please consider giving us a review so more people can discover the show. Today we are talking about the best ways, the most effective ways to capitalize on this moment. And we're joined by Tyler Stovall, Dean of the Humanities Division at UC Santa Cruz, President of the American Historical Association. He's working on a book about freedom and race called White Freedom. We're also joined by Nancy Eisenberg, Professor of History at Louisiana State University and author of White Trash, the 400-year untold story of class in America. And we have a number of people on the line who'd like to join us. So let's hear from Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Let me turn this on. Well, the range of topics in this show have been just mind-boggling. My head is spinning with all the information, and it's very wonderful. But I wanted to zoom in on one small area, which is labor unions. You know, they can be, and they often are, a great class and race equalizer, bringing, you know, poor people, often minority people, into the middle class. For example, I'm a retiree member of a big public employee union here, SEIU, and I work for the city and county of San Francisco, where people of many races and classes and educational levels were raised up by fair wages and benefits, you know. And now public employees are under assault by a case that's going to the Supreme Court to try to destroy our unions economically by making them open shops, which means that paying for representation, you know, by unions will be optional. You don't have to pay your dues. You just don't join and don't have to pay. Now, even if you don't join the union, you have to pay a fee. You know, this is also called right to work. Mm-hmm. It's the same as right to work. So we're trying to bring more workers into union protection. You know, we're trying to organize more industries and to maintain standards that we want to bring others up to. Instead, we're going to lose our ability to organize and win good contracts if we're economically, you know, destroyed. And in another issue in San Francisco is that one of the last relics of reliable defined benefit pensions, meaning that you know what you're going to get when you retire, and you can plan that way, are being threatened with becoming 401ks. That's right here in our San Francisco retirement system.
Huh. Can you send information about that to us, and then we'll put it on our show list? That's a really important one.
Yeah, it might take a couple of days, but I can.
Okay, well, and we'll look it up. Thank you so much, Judy. Tyler, do you want to tackle this one? I mean, this is an age-old question that people were even asking. Well, Martin Luther King was really focusing on this for sure, but how do you bridge this gap and create a message that speaks to the working class who should be in solidarity with so many of the people who took to the streets this weekend?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in some ways it is a $64 question in American politics, especially in American progressive politics. Let me just make a couple of points. First of all, the campaign against unions that the caller was talking about has a long, long history in America. Right to work is a very old conception. And we've seen it gather steam in the last few decades. And the decline of unions in America is very much part and parcel of the decline of working-class living standards. There's no two ways about it. And yet there has been a political inability to sort of make that case. And I think that's one of the things that people who see themselves as progressives have to re-embrace, the idea that, you know, if you're not going to have unionized labor, you're not going to have unions, you're not going to have the kind of working-class living standards that are going to permit people to prosper. And I think also the caller is right in that it is true that unions have often been one of the major sources of upward mobility, not just upward mobility, but also multiracial upward mobility. I mean, there was a survey a while back that said there were really essentially two institutions in American life that were promoting the upward mobility of African Americans. One were unions, and the other was the military. Mm. And it's interesting to note that this decline in working class living standards also is accompanied by the end of required conscription in America. And that's another way in which you have this distinction between the haves and have-nots in our society. So I think that, you know, the question is, how do we make this argument? I think, you know, we had an example last year in the campaign of Bernie Sanders, who was trying to tackle these questions frontally with some success. Although, of course, he didn't win the presidency, but I think that's something that we need to consider more closely.
Nancy, what do you think? There's going to be a revival of the Poor People's Campaign across the country. The Moral Mondays in North Carolina really took off, and then tonight in Milwaukee, there's a national call for moral revival mass meeting for the Poor People's Campaign. What do you think about their message, and if would you change anything, or what are your thoughts about how this campaign could really reach out to the white working class or the working class people that you write about in your book?
Yeah, I think it's always complicated. I mean, you can't, you know, you can organize a rally and people are going to interpret it in a variety of different ways. But I do think what I think has to be done is that we have to talk about the class divide and we have to connect it to race and to gender. Mm-hmm. You know, women are also the majority of people who live below the poverty line, women and children. And we one of the problems, one of the interesting things that I found when I was, you know, when my book came out, I was so surprised. One interviewer said to me that she'd been told by a news reporter that, well, if we talk about race, we can't, you know, if we talk about class, we then can't talk about race. Now, from an academic, that's totally insane. Clearly, there's this problem we have often with the public media that problems get watered down, too simplified. And we also have this problem that some people construct this as a battle. that if we focus on class, and this is part of the problem with talking about the white working class, as Tyler has talked about. I mean, there has been a massive increase of African-American women, women of color, who are now in unions. And unfortunately, the media and Trump, you know, are living in this idea that it's white men in hard hats that somehow define the working class. And I think the coverage of Trump's rallies has been confused with what the working class really looks like today. So one of the issues is, and this is one of the biggest problems we have, and I think that the Democrats have, is right now we also live in a fact-free world. So when you try to present the evidence, and this is one of the things that, that Trump has exploited, you know, he can turn around and say that's fake news, or he can invent his own statistics, or, you know, and unfortunately, we are in a universe where people can go on the Internet and find the facts they want, as opposed to being exposed to a broad range of information. So it's a really tough battle to actually explain to people, you know, how class affects them. And as I wrote in my book, Americans have a, have throughout history actually often defined people by class. We are very class conscious. We have always been class conscious. But then often we like to cover it up and pretend that we escaped class at the time of the American Revolution. That was somehow some old-fashioned British thing that we left behind. And this is the difficulty as well, is that people feel really uncomfortable talking about class because then they have to start looking at themselves and the privileges they've been given. And it's really, really difficult at times for people of the middle and the upper middle class to fully embrace the privileges they've gotten that are not about merit. And I will just repeat this statistic that I think is really important. One of the major predictors of being successful in America today is dependent on the wealth and privileges that you get from your parents and even from your ancestors. Mm-hmm. And that's why I talk about the importance of pedigree. I talk about the importance of nepotism. And people pretend like, well, if your parents pay for you to go to a private school and pay for you to go to, you know, expensive art camp in the summer and, you know, send you to courses to take the, to take your exams to get into college, all these privileges, in a sense, pave the way for a world that starts even before you're born. And this is one of the things we refuse to admit. We just say, oh, yes, of course parents are going to help their children. But we deny and we don't talk about how class is defined. It's reproduced in families. And that's a really tough issue for people to get their heads around.
Tyler, you recently wrote a piece for the American Historical Association called Race, Class, and History in the Trump Era, and you wrote about how these issues, race and class in particular, have a long and complex history in American life. We could probably do an entire show on that, but what would you add? What was the main point you wanted to make?
Well, there were a number of things. I mean, first of all, as Nancy said, that these are very complicated issues. You really cannot, in American history and perhaps world history, separate distinctions between race and class. I mean, for example, one of my interests is the history of the Caribbean, where ideas of race and class are so tightly intermingled that to call somebody black in the Caribbean is to call them lower class. And to so the discussion of skin color is also a question of class automatically. But I think that Nancy is right. There's been a tendency not to want to look at these issues. One of the formative books I can remember reading when I was in high school was a book by a 1950s pop sociologist, Vance Packard, called The Status Seekers. And in an era where nobody was talking about class, Packard went down point by point by point, displaying the ways in which class was a fundamental dividing line in American society. Now, that was a long time ago. Nowadays, what you have, for example, is, as Nancy said, families, middle-class families investing heavily in the education of their children. The decline of public schools, for example, or the increased tendency of upper-middle-class and wealthy parents to send their kids to private schools, not to mention enrichment activities in the summer, all those make a difference, not just immediately, but in the long term. And so without any discussion of that, it's very hard to address these fundamental cleavages that we have in American society. Because everybody tends to say, well, I did it myself, I earned it, these are privileges I deserve. Well, maybe they do deserve them, but not everybody gets them. And it is a real cleavage that America is becoming more and more inegalitarian, and yet very few people seem to have an answer for what to do about it.
Hmm. Yeah, according to the Labor Department, half of the jobs in the United States currently pay less than $18 an hour. That's right. $37,000 a year if someone works full-time. And 40% of the jobs pay less than $15.50 an hour.
Right, right. And for example, I mean, living in the Bay Area, you know, you can just imagine what $37,000 a year is going to get you.
Right.
It's not going to get you a decent place to live, if a place at all.
No, exactly. People are living 2 or 3 hours away from their jobs right now. Today we're speaking with Tyler Stovall, Dean of the Humanities Division at UC Santa Cruz. He's author of a number of books, including Black France, The History of Politics of Blackness. He's working on a book about freedom and race. Nancy Eisenberg is professor of history at Louisiana State University and author of White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. Today we are talking about a number of issues, but the main question is, how should we capitalize on this moment and really talk about race, class, labor, the ability to make ends meet? So many people cannot. So many people are living in poverty. So how do we do this? And then the other big question is, you know, ensuring that working class people find solidarity, for example, with the people we saw on the streets over the weekend. And we have full lines. Let's go to Suzette. Hi, Suzette. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for taking my call. I should tell you, I'm really angry. I've got my cranky pants on, so I will try to walk the line between self-righteousness and gas-bagging. And I hope my facts are correct, and if not, I guess I'm as bad as everybody else. I'm a compulsive reader, but what I find the most offensive about the culture we live in now, I grew up in Berkeley. I'm 61. I love the Bay Area. I think of it as a multicultural area, but it's becoming so gentrified. We're talking about the economics of racism, to me, and I could go off on that, but just a couple things I'd like to throw out there. As far as I know, less than 100 years ago, there were still bounties in Northern California on Native Americans, bounties for to kill people. We never talk about that. That has everything to do with everything. You have Native American ancestry, am I correct?
Yes.
And why is that? That should be out there. The first African American professor at UC Berkeley, Professor Blackwell, he experienced when he moved here huge amounts of racism. Does anybody know that Barack Obama gave him the highest civilian honor a few years ago, posthumously? We don't talk about that stuff. And I believe we also, at one point, in Martinez or one of the Contra Costa County communities, had the biggest KKK membership in the country. That just, we don't talk about that stuff. And you know, I know being really angry doesn't help, but it's like, bring that stuff up, step up. And the last thing I'll say, as a reader, I have committed this to memory. Page 234 of Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad. One thing about the South, quote, one thing about the South, it was not patient when it came to killing Negroes, end quote. Mm. And that's as applicable today as it was whenever. I know that's a magical realism story. But I don't know what to say. I have no words, so I'll just leave it at that. Thank you for taking my call.
I feel you, Suzette. Thank you for your call. And we talk about these issues on this show. I'm hoping that, again, people are waking up and talking about these issues. There's a couple, if you want to read about these issues, Murder State by Brendan Lindsay focuses on Native genocide in California, and An American Genocide by Benjamin Madley. We're going to do a show about Native American activism on Wednesday. But I completely hear you, Suzette. And, you know, let me take a few more calls, and then I'll get our guests to respond. But thank you for calling. Anytime, please call in and vent. That's totally fine. Let's go next to Dan in San Francisco. Hey, hi, Dan. Welcome to the show.
If you need help...
Do we lose Dan? Is Dan there? No, we lost Dan. Okay. What about the issue... Suzette brought up a number of issues there, Tyler. Like so many people, are very frustrated about what we're dealing with right now.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And, you know, let's face it. I mean, American history isn't always pretty. There's a lot of very bad things that have happened in this country to a lot of people. And part of the resistance in dealing with history, as Nancy said at the outset, is precisely coming to terms with that. But we have to come to terms with that, and we have to deal with that in a way that expands opportunities for all people. You've been asking about how do we go forward and how do we deal with the situation. I think one of the skills that historians develop and people in the humanities develop in general is telling stories. We're very good at telling stories. And so Nancy is right. We do live in a, quote, fact-free world in many ways, or people simply reject any kind of objective knowledge. But those people are also open to, I think, I hope, to narratives. And if you can reach them at the level of stories that have happened to individual people, sometimes that might be more effective. And we're very good at telling stories.
Nancy, what would you add?
Yeah, I would like to say that the caller's right about Native Americans. I write about that. Particularly in the unique history of California. I mean, California, when it became a state of the Union, prohibited slavery but established the peonage of Native Americans. So they created an alternative form of slavery. And I write extensively about how British ideas about Native Americans shaped notions of class. So again, we're back to this important idea that I hope the listeners will come away with, that you actually, to understand race, you have to understand class, and you also have to understand gender. Mm. These things are intimately connected. When I talk about the reproduction of class, when I talk about when this country was founded, the way in which the strength of a country was measured in its demographic size, and that meant women were seen as breeders. This is something Jefferson and Franklin widely accepted. So we have to pay attention and not just sort of assume, not go for one simple answer. I know that's hard, but it's one of the things that I hope that the listeners will continue to read. I hope they will continue to embrace the good and the bad of the American past, not just to get angry, though, to think about how can we come up with constructive solutions. How can we bridge the divide, and as I suggested, you know, the divide between rural and urban America? I mean, that's one problem. It's not the only problem, but it's one that I think we could think about more seriously. And as the other caller mentioned, the idea of paying more attention to the demise of labor unions and how devastating that's been, because the other myth that we fall prey to is not everyone can go to college.
Right.
We can't assume that that's the only method or means of upward mobility, and that because it simply can't happen. So we have to think of ways to create an economy that can embrace different people who have different skills.
Well, and to that point, people want to go to college. I just read in the New York Times about what's happening in New York when Governor Cuomo won approval for his scholarship program to make college tuition free for students at New York's public colleges and universities. The state anticipated that about 23,000 people would benefit and 75,000 applied.
Yeah,
that says so much.
Right.
People want an education. Right, Tyler?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's happened, of course, is in terms of the decline of working classes, that college has gotten so much more expensive.
Yep.
Incredibly so. And that really has an impact in terms of sorting people out into different class levels. Absolutely.
Mm. Well, go ahead, Nancy.
Wanted to add one thing. You know, I thought it was interesting that Tyler mentioned that Vance Packard, because I actually write about him. He was a best-selling author and a really important book that talked about the growth of class in suburbia, and that's the thing I also write about. You know, the class division also comes from where you live. We have zoning laws which divide people by class and divided people by ethnicity and race. And that's, again, something we need to understand. Where you live is determined by your wealth and your ability to choose a neighborhood based on certain class privileges.
You know,
more thing. Another book that I think people should really read is Barbara Ehrenreich's Nickeled and Dimed. Mm. I mean, that was a book that really opened my eyes. When we think about people who are struggling to get by and we think they're lazy, no, they're often working one, two jobs.
Right.
And they're still not making enough. And I think that's another thing that we have to stop stigmatizing the poor. And that's a really hard thing for Americans to overcome, because we compare our success to those who fail.
Exactly, and stop demoralizing immigrants. The New York Times had a piece about the horrific floods, the devastating floods in Texas, and there's a picture of a woman, Gloria Maria Quintanilla, and she was actually walking to work in Houston. It took her about an hour to walk to work. She's lived here since 1982. She's an immigrant from El Salvador. She was going to the DoubleTree, where she washes and irons sheets. She makes $10 an hour. Quick thoughts on, we didn't really talk about immigration, but that's also an important part of this discussion, Tyler.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And people are very divided about the whole question of immigration. They feel that there's a tendency to look down on immigrants as poor people, as people that are taking, quote, American jobs. And yet, first of all, the immigrants wouldn't be here if they weren't sought out by employers,
right,
because they furnish an important labor base to this country. But they are very easy as communities to demonize, especially if they are culturally different, which they usually are for many Americans that have been here for a long time. And they're very easy to focus on as the problem with America. You know, one of the challenges we're looking at in American society is, well, the disappearance of work in general. You know, people don't talk about it very much, but there's a whole crisis of robotization that is looming. And so increasingly, we're going to be looking at a world where people will not be working at all.
Mm.
And how are we going to deal with that?
Right. And the global race to the bottom.
Right.
We have just about a minute left, and I'd like you both to talk about what strikes you about how the media cover these issues, because media coverage of these issues is so, so important. Nancy, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, like everything with the media, can be mixed. I mean, I felt like the cover in Charlottesville, I mean, at least I read the Post regularly. They had a wide range of pieces. I was glad to see that. It wasn't just, you know, just outrage, because I just think that, you know, this is the problem. The media often just goes to outrage, and then they move on to the next issue, mm-hmm, and they don't follow up. But I felt the coverage there was pretty good. But this is the problem I think we live in today. We live in a world where the media deals with problems in 2 minutes,
mm-hmm,
and then we forget it, and we move on. And I think that's, problems need to be discussed, and they need to be connected not just to scandalous moments. They have to be connected to a broader narrative about where do these problems come from.
Mm. Tyler, final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, let me give you a very concrete
example. In about 30
example.
Seconds.
I spent part of the morning reading the media coverage from different outlets of the demonstrations that happened in Berkeley yesterday, and I was struck at how divergent the coverage was. I mean, you know, if you read some outlets, you would think that everybody at the counter-demonstration march was dressed in black clothing and had face masks on and billy clubs in their hands,
mm-hmm,
right? If you read other outlets that said that those people were minimal. So I can understand why there is a lot of confusion out there,
mm-hmm,
in terms of not knowing what to believe. Because as Nancy said, if you're looking for something, you can find just about anything.
Right.
And so I think what it means is that people really have to read very carefully and very actively to get some sense of what's going on in the world today.
Well, you both brought up so many issues, and we'd love to have you back. I think we should regularly talk about all of this because it's so, so important. Tyler Stovall, Dean of the Humanities Division at UC Santa Cruz, President of the American Historical Association, and author of Black France, The History and Politics of Blackness. Nancy Eisenberg is Professor of History at Louisiana State and author of White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. Nancy and Tyler, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.